Hello, Broncos fans, and to anyone else who might not be fans but are interested anyway, thank you for tuning in for our Week 3 DenverBroncos.com podcast. We've got a very highly anticipated matchup this Sunday, and so our slate will have no shortage of interesting topics. I'm your host, Ben Swanson, and with me as always to break it down is our columnist, Andrew Mason. And we've got a couple guests from our offices to discuss what happened in the AFC West this past week. To start off, let's recap the Broncos' win over the Chiefs. Once again, the Broncos had a hot start with three touchdowns through the air. Julius Thomas caught the first, Jacob Tammy caught the second, and Demaryius Thomas caught the third. At the half, the Broncos had reeled off two unanswered touchdowns and took a 21-10 lead into the break. But the second half brought up some uncomfortable memories from Week 1 as the Chiefs dominated the time of possession and got within a touchdown of tying the game in the final moments. And not only were they within a touchdown, but they were within just a couple yards of tying the game, with their last drive ending on a failed fourth down attempt on the Broncos' 2-yard line, with Terrence Knighton deflecting Alex Smith's pass at the line of scrimmage. Regardless, the Broncos came away with a 24-17 win, and they're now 2-0, in large part thanks to the defense's suspenseful stops in each of the games. Naturally, the defense would prefer not to let the games get to that point going forward. One of the glaring statistics from Sunday was the Chiefs' third down efficiency, 11 of 16. It stands to reason that cutting down on that would have solved some issues on defense and also on offense. The time of possession would probably have been a bit more even, but the major impact would definitely have been on the defensive side, getting Kansas City's offense off the field. Mace, what do they need to do to improve upon that?
Well, 11 of 16 actually only begins to tell the story because they also gave up three third downs on penalties. That doesn't count toward those numbers, but really that takes you to kind of to 14 of 19 times that the Chiefs got in a third down and sustained that drive. And that leads to the focus beyond third down for the defense, which has been penalties, which has been all the mistakes that they made. Now, you know, you can question one of the calls, the Chris Harris penalty in the end zone on a third down on the Chiefs' first drive of the second half. That really was ticky-tack at best and probably should have been a no call because you had two guys engaged against each other. There really wasn't an advantage gained. But, the other thing that jumps out is how often the Chiefs were in third and long and converted. I'm not even talking about third and six, third and seven. You're talking about getting towards like third and 15 and beyond, and they were able to keep drives going. You know, part of it was what the Chiefs did. Give them credit. They executed well. But I also think the Broncos, haven't been aggressive defensively. There were some things that we saw in the preseason in terms of the pass rush, in terms of blitzes, not only from the linebackers but also using T.J. Ward in the pass rush that we haven't seen the first couple of games. And I think part of that is due to the fact that you don't have as many practices in the offseason as you used to. You don't have as many training camp sessions as much in pads. So sometimes you're still kind of working on things, figuring out what you can do. But I also wonder if they aren't holding back a little bit in terms of their tactics, and maybe we're going to see some more exotic stuff this week. Certainly we know that when Jack Del Rio has the personnel to attack, he loves to do it. You go back to 2012, this was a very aggressive defense because it was healthy. He had the personnel to do it. Then in 2013, a lot of injuries, had to kind of scale back. Well, now he's got a healthy defense for the most part, except for Danny Trevathan, who they're expecting back after the bye. And I wonder if there's going to be a little more creativity from Jack Del Rio this week.
It was certainly a tough win for the Broncos, who moved to 2-0, and a very tough loss for the Kansas City Chiefs, who moved to 0-2 amid a very difficult division in the AFC West. Now we'll turn to our roundup of the AFC West, looking at the other two participants, the Oakland Raiders and the San Diego Chargers. With the Broncos-Chiefs divisional game already covered, our AFC West roundup today will look at just the Raiders and the Chargers. This week, we have our two digital media interns reporting on them. First up is Lauren Giudice talking Raiders, and in a minute, we'll be joined by David Deschant on the Chargers. So, Lauren, the Raiders had a loss at home, 30-14 to Houston. What did you take away from that game?
Well, the Raiders' woes and 8-game losing streak continues. During the preseason, this really looked like a game that the Raiders could come away with a win, but four turnovers in scoring territory. They didn't really give themselves a chance. One of those turnovers, you guys probably saw it on SportsCenter, was a bizarre play where James Jones caught a 20-yard pass from Derek Carr late in the first half before getting stripped by Jonathan Joseph at the Houston 35. But Jones picked up the ball and ran towards the end zone, but Joseph knocked the ball out again, and Peyton Manning's favorite Texan, DJ Swearinger, recovered it. You know, it was bad from the start for the Raiders, as the Texans' first drive, a 10-play, 80-yard march down the field, resulted in a touchdown reception from none other than J.J. Watt. On the Raiders' first promising drive of the day, Carr was picked off by Kareem Jackson, and that set up a Texans field goal. And during their opening drive in the third quarter, Michael Rivera fumbled the ball, and the Texans returned it to the Oakland 21, setting up a 12-yard touchdown pass from Ryan Fitzpatrick to DeAndre Hopkins. The Texans outgained the Raiders 150 yards to 3 in the first quarter, and things didn't get much better for Oakland from there. The Raiders were down 27-0 after three quarters and snuck in two touchdowns in the fourth quarter. While they did get those two scores, one on a Darren McFadden 1-yard run and a James Jones 9-yard reception, it wasn't nearly enough. Carr played like you would expect from a rookie starting in his second NFL game, going 27 of 42 for 263 yards, a touchdown and two interceptions. But he really didn't get much help from his receivers, and he also led the Raiders with 58 rushing yards as they totaled just 101 yards on the ground. While the Raiders' offensive struggles were glaring, the defense allowed Houston to run for 188 yards on 46 carries and control the clock for 38 minutes and 36 seconds. You know, the Raiders defenders had really barely any time to rest, and Arian Foster took advantage of that with 138 yards of his own on 28 rushes. Third downs were huge in this game as the Texans converted on 9 of 15 and the Raiders were just 2 of 9. With a third down efficiency like that and four turnovers, it's really tough to get points on the board. And as Coach Dennis Allen said in his opening remarks after the game, that's a recipe for getting your butt kicked. And the Raiders will need to regroup and regroup fast as they head to Foxborough to take on the Patriots on Sunday.
As me and Mace talked about last week, the Raiders really need to get their rushing game going if they want to have a chance in these kind of games. Darren McFadden had 12 rushes for only 37 yards, which is obviously not getting that going. In fact, Derek Carr, the quarterback, had more yards with 58 after having a big long run of 41 yards. Clearly, you don't want your rookie throwing 42 times, and against a pass rush like Houston's, that's not a recipe for success. So the Raiders dropped to 0-2 into the bottom of the division. Looking to the Chargers, they took away a pretty great game, beating the defending champions Seahawks. David, how did that game go, and what did you take away?
Sure, yeah, you know, it was an interesting game, a kind of a statement win for the Chargers. You know, slow start for both teams. Seahawks took the lead on a big run by Percy Harvin. Debatably could have been called back for him stepping out of bounds. But then the Chargers really kind of imposed their will on the game in the second quarter. They marched down the field for a touchdown, taking up about 4 minutes, and then forced a three and out right away. Got the ball back, got a field goal, and then forced a turnover on the ensuing kickoff, forcing a fumble for Harvin. They recovered the fumble, went back down the field, scored another touchdown, this one also to Antonio Gates, who caught the first one, and suddenly they're up 20-7. From that point, the Chargers really, you know, played a Chargers kind of game. They really possessed the ball as much as they could. The time of possession by the end was, I believe, 42 minutes for the Chargers, as opposed to 17:45 for the Seahawks. Because of that, the Chargers got to run 75 plays to the Seahawks' 40 plays. So, you know, it's a lot like the Broncos-Chiefs game that we saw. It's hard to create on offense when you don't have that many plays, and that's exactly what happened for Seattle. Antonio Gates was really big in this game for the Chargers. He caught three touchdowns. Seems like the Seahawks just couldn't quite corral him. Phillip Rivers continued to find him in very tight windows in the second half. Gates made an incredible one-handed catch to put the Chargers back up 13, and from that point, the Seahawks really just couldn't come back. They didn't have enough time. Even in the second half, the Chargers punted three times, but they still held the ball on each of those drives. The first drive, I think they held it 3:30 before punting, and then twice more, they held it almost 5 minutes before punting. So they really bled the clock, even when they weren't scoring, and it kept the Seahawks from being able to come back in this game. Another interesting part of this game, the temperature down on the field. Some of the thermometers at field level were reading nearly 120 degrees. The Chargers were wearing white, so they made the Seahawks wear blue. Obviously, that could have been a factor. Earl Thomas left the game with cramps. Several players seem to be affected by it, and really the Chargers, with their ball control offense, running 75 plays, kind of made that a bigger factor, wore down the defense in the heat, certainly made them struggle a little bit. Looking forward, this is, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the Chargers do next week. They play Buffalo, who's 2-0, surprisingly so. They play Buffalo in Buffalo, where they seem to be tough to beat. They also lost Ryan Matthews this week to a sprained MCL. He might be out 4 or 5 weeks. We'll see if he comes back before they play the Broncos in week 8 on Thursday night. But certainly will be interesting to see how they do against the Bills. It also shows us kind of an interesting angle for the Seahawks-Broncos game coming up this week. Obviously, the Chargers showed that the Seahawks are beatable. Seahawks are a bit of a different team at home, we know. Over the past 3 years in the regular season, they're 16-1 at home, as 9-8 on the road. So certainly it'll be a different animal with that crowd at CenturyLink Field. But, you know, maybe the Broncos can look to target Julius Thomas a little bit more. They saw what Antonio Gates did to the Seahawks, use that tight end, that similar style. Maybe they can find some holes there and pick up some good yardage. And they also, you know, should look to hold the ball the same way the Chargers did, make the game shorter, wear down the defense, and hopefully try to quiet that crowd.
Thank you, David. The focus with that game was probably going to be a lot on the Seahawks. For a lot of fans and a lot of people, this game coming up between the Broncos and Seattle is, you know, a huge rematch. There's only been regular season rematches of Super Bowl games 5 times. But looking at the Chargers within the division, they could be a very dangerous team. Now we've got the game that everyone's going to be looking at. Everyone's going to be watching this. A very rare Super Bowl quote-unquote rematch. You know, obviously these aren't the same teams. It's not the same season. There's no high stakes like there were when you're in the Super Bowl, so it's not quite the same. But this has only happened 5 times before when the two teams who were in the Super Bowl the previous year play each other. Now, we're barely half a year removed from the Super Bowl, so this is, of course, going to be in the back of minds of a lot of players on either side. But what's the vibe like in the locker room? Do they think it's going to be like a rematch or a revenge, or is this just like another game?
It's not just another game. I mean, you've heard guys like Chris Harris Jr., Terrence Knight, and, you know, admitting that it's a, you know, that there's going to be a different emotional tenor to this game because of what happened in the Super Bowl. Chris Harris has talked about this being a chance to make a statement given what happened in the Super Bowl, but you can't let it be the be-all, end-all, and I think they recognize that, and there's also a pretty clear understanding that you're not going to get revenge in this game. You know, like you alluded to, it's just a regular season game. It, you know, doesn't have the same heft, doesn't have the same consequence, and nothing from February is going to be undone, no matter how this game turns out. Denver could win the game 31-0, and it will do nothing in terms of quote-unquote revenge or make, you know, or taking away the pain of what happened on Groundhog Day. So, you know, I think they've got this game in the proper perspective. Now it will be key no matter what the result, to maintain that perspective. You can't get too high, you can't get too low about this. And that's where I think it's probably a good thing that the bye comes after this game. If you lose, then the bye gives you a chance to reset, reflect, and be ready for a very tough slate of games that starts after the bye in week 5 when Arizona comes in. I mean, just look at, you have Arizona, you have then at the Jets, and the Jets are, you know, up and down, but it's still a cross-country road trip. And then you've got San Francisco coming in, San Diego coming in, and at New England. That's as rigorous a 5-game stretch as any team is going to see over the course of this season. So win or lose, you don't want to go too overconfident if you win. You don't want to mope and think it's the end of the season if you lose. And that's why I think it's probably a good thing the Broncos will have that extra week to kind of reflect, reassess, and then go forward from there and not get too caught up in what the result of week 3 is.
One of the things that people who might be anticipating this as sort of a revenge game have to take into consideration is that this Broncos team isn't the same that it was. You have injuries, you have new acquisitions. I mean, I've got a list about 8 people here: Aqib Talib, T.J. Ward, DeMarcus Ware, Derek Wolfe, Von Miller, Ryan Clady, Raheem Moore, Chris Harris Jr., all those guys who didn't play in that game, and now they're coming into this game. And you also got Monte Ball stepping up into a new role. This is definitely not the same team that people saw in the Super Bowl. Is this kind of the same kind of feeling for Seattle? How different are they this season?
Well, they're different than what they were for most of last year. A bit different. And you start with not having Golden Tate anymore. He, of course, is in Detroit. But also not having Percy Harvin for most of 2013. But, of course, he was there in the postseason. He was there in the Super Bowl. It was interesting to look at the rosters on that day. The Broncos roster was the weakest it had been all last year by the time they got to the Super Bowl, given what they'd lost. And just to further illustrate the difference in the Broncos now from Super Sunday, you're going to have 9 guys in the starting lineup that were not on the 53-man roster on Super Bowl Sunday for the Broncos. So, I mean, you know, well over 40% of the lineup is changed from Super Bowl Sunday. So that has to be taken into account. But then to go back to the Seahawks, their roster, I think, was at the strongest it had been all year, and it's because they had Percy Harvin available. He missed the regular season, came back in the postseason, and was really just finally rounding into form just in time for the Super Bowl. Because he played so little for the Seahawks, it created a strategic problem for the Broncos because they didn't have much film of Harvin in a Seahawk uniform they could study. You know, Terrence Knight and others have talked about that they had to go back to the film of Percy Harvin with the Vikings to try to get a feel for what the Seahawks might do. But again, different scheme, different personnel. You were basically kind of going on guesswork, and the Seahawks unleashed a lot of Percy Harvin in Super Sunday. We saw like the jet sweeps that we've seen quite a bit of the last two games as well for the Seahawks, but they really exploited those in the Super Bowl. It was their first chance to play with a new toy. And they were just and they were using that in every way possible, and it kept the Broncos' defense off balance. So that's why I kind of look at Percy Harvin when I'm looking at this game, because he's the one that really transformed the Seahawk offense and made it something that the Broncos' defense, which was injured and struggling at that point, but Harvin is what transformed that offense into something that the Broncos couldn't control. So we'll see how that goes Sunday.
You talk about Percy Harvin. That's the guy that I'm looking at this game. I think I saw that he was averaging about 10 yards a carry. And you see that on that jet sweep. They go right around the corner and they get, you know, a first down on a lot of tries. How do you prevent him from turning the corner? How do you prevent them from getting those big gains?
It's tough. I mean, it's the very definition of a team effort. You've got to have speed on the edges. You've got to have safeties that can come up and make the tackle, or at least hold him up until someone else can arrive. You've got to have linebackers who can cover the field from sideline to sideline. In that situation is where you're going to miss Danny Trevathan quite a bit. And he's been working out on the practice field this week, but his return is not projected until the Cardinals game in Week 5 or the Jets game in Week 6. So Brandon Marshall and Nate Irving are going to have quite a few responsibilities. You've got to have speed, but you've got to be able to wrap up. And the other thing with Harvin, don't forget, he can be physical against an opposing corner. I was going back and looking at the earlier game he played against the Broncos back in 2011 when he was still with the Vikings, and one of his touchdowns came, and this wasn't on the jet sweep. This was actually just on a short pass. He's effective on that as well. He's actually the Seahawks' leading receiver through two games. But on this touchdown, Chris Harris is against him. Chris is lined up in the slot as he usually has been over the course of his career, and Harvin gets a lines up 2.5 yards behind the line of scrimmage, to get some run up time to accelerate. And then he runs up to Harris, and Harris gets his hands up, and he pushes off on him. It's a push-off, but at the same time, the ball wasn't in the air, and B, it was within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, so it was in that range where you're allowed to have some kind of, you're allowed contact. That contact knocks Harris off balance, and all of a sudden, Harvin has separation. Next thing you know, Christian Ponder, the Vikings quarterback then, released the ball. Harvin's got it, and he's gone. So there's so many things you have to focus on with him. There's so many ways that he can beat you. And we haven't even talked about special teams. When he had the back-breaking play on the kickoff, on the touchdown on the kickoff return at the opening of the second half in the Super Bowl. So just so many ways that he can beat you. And quite simply, and as has been said in the locker room this week, you have to know where he is at all times. Not that other guys can't beat you, not that Russell Wilson can't make plays with his arm and with his feet, not that Marshawn Lynch can't make some big plays. He's averaging 5.6 yards a carry so far this year. But Harvin's the guy that really transformed that offense in the postseason and made it something the Broncos couldn't corral.
Speaking of Seattle's offense, we focused a lot about their passing offense, when in fact, and I guess a little bit on their running offense with the read option, but their rushing offense with Marshawn Lynch, or even with that read option going, you know, if Russell Wilson decides he wants to kind of peel out on the other side, how difficult is defending so many different facets of their offense between the passing, the rushing, and the option?
It's tough. It limits the tactical creativity the defense can have sometimes, because you've probably got to spy Russell Wilson to make sure he doesn't make too many plays with his feet. But then you've got to have solid coverage on the back end. I mean, really, the onus is going to be on Aqib Talib, Chris Harris, and Bradley Roby. When they're not responsible for Percy Harvin, they've got to take care of the guys they're facing, and they've got to take care of them one-on-one. Because if you want to contain the other aspects of that offense, if you want to contain Russell Wilson when he's scrambling, if you want to keep Marshawn Lynch from getting to the second level, your linebackers and also your safeties are going to have to come up and make some plays. T.J. Ward could have as big an impact on this game as he does the rest of the season. And this is the kind of game that T.J. Ward was brought here for. Because he can be aggressive. You can use him. You can use him as a linebacker. You can use him in the pass rush. You can bring him forward and drop Raheem Moore back as a single high safety. There's so many things you can do with T.J. Ward, and it's reminiscent of what the Seahawks like to do with their safeties as well. That it gives the Broncos some options, but again, the guys at cornerback are going to have to make sure that they've got their receivers locked down one-on-one, so T.J. Ward and Raheem Moore are a bit more free to roam and a bit more free to try to make some plays and keep Wilson and Harvin when he's underneath and Marshawn Lynch contained.
Speaking of Seattle safeties, that whole secondary is one of the best we've seen in recent history. The Legion of Boom defense, led by, of course, Richard Sherman at cornerback. We talked to him on the phone on Wednesday, and he was saying what makes them so special is how invested they are in each of their own responsibilities. They come together, and they make a passing defense that's second to very few, if not none. How tough will it be for the Broncos offense to get things going in the passing offense?
It'll be difficult. Let's just go back to the Super Bowl now. Obviously, the Broncos, I think, are going to be stronger in pass protection than they were on Super Sunday, because they did not have Ryan Clady in the lineup. And I think you had Orlando Franklin and Chris Clark working at the tackles, and I think both of them got exposed a little bit in that game by the Seahawks edge rushers. But there's just so much speed over that entire defense. I still have visions from that game of seeing Demaryius Thomas take the lick across the middle and on a drag route, or seeing screen passes that were blown up from the backside. It's the combination of speed and aggression. And you talked about the safeties. I think the safeties make that whole defense go. Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas. I think you could have made a case for Cam Chancellor being the MVP of Super Bowl of 48. That's how strong he is. That's how much he and Earl Thomas change what teams do. So how do you counter that quickness? Well, for one thing, you've got to hold up better in the pass rush, and you don't want Peyton Manning to get hit the way he was hit in the Super Bowl, which set up some turnovers. So the other thing is, you've got to have a change of pace, particularly in the run game, that forces the Seahawks to dial back their aggression. The Broncos' ground game in Super Bowl 48 never got going, and I'm not saying this would have changed the result of the game. When you lose 43-8, a hell of a lot goes wrong. I mean, it's 10 things going wrong, not one thing. But go back to the end of the first quarter when it's still 8-0. It's still a competitive game. And what the Broncos needed, even though it's counterintuitive considering their emphasis on up-tempo football, what they needed to do was to get the pace back down a little bit. Seattle was dictating it. They were keeping it on, you know, their offense was keeping the defense off balance with the speed, particularly when you saw Russell Wilson get out of the pocket and Percy Harvin make some plays. And then on defense, the Seahawks' speed and aggression was disrupting the timing of the Broncos' passing game, and they were able to pretty much tee off because they weren't concerned about the run. If the Broncos could have ground out two or three first downs on a series, even if they hadn't scored, even if they'd eventually punted, I think it would have forced the Seahawks to throttle back, but the run game never flourished to the point where the Seahawks had to take it seriously. So let's look at what the Broncos have done the first two games. You know, they've tried to establish the run on first down. There's been mixed results. They've tried to work the run on third downs, which has actually gotten better results. The only third down run that the Broncos did not get a first down on in the first 2 weeks was when Monte Ball gained 23 yards on 3rd and 24, and that set up a chance to go for it, and they were able to keep the sticks moving. So that was a successful play. So seeing that sort of, and this is not counting the kneel down on third down they had at the end of the Colts game. So that sort of success is something that they can build on. And if they can have that tool in their drawer and be able to use it, I think they can force Seattle to play back just a little bit and maybe not be as aggressive on the Broncos' routes, and I think that'll open up stuff in the passing game.
Speaking of the passing game, in Seattle's game last week against San Diego, we saw Antonio Gates come away with 3 touchdowns and almost 100 yards receiving. It's difficult covering him as an athletic tight end who, when he's in man coverage, is not very easy to wrangle. Julius Thomas is also kind of like that. Does that bode well for the Broncos this week?
It could. They were able to contain Julius Thomas in the Super Bowl. So, you know, I wonder if they just didn't take Antonio Gates as seriously as they should have. It could, but they did contain Julius Thomas in the Super Bowl. So I wouldn't be so quick to say that they can't cover tight ends very well. I don't necessarily think this is a deep flaw in the Seahawk defense, but if you're the Broncos, you certainly want to try that. That's where I expect the aggression of their safeties if they attack with them. I think that's one area where they can disrupt the Broncos passing game. But you know what you saw sometimes with the Chargers game, you know, using linebackers on Antonio Gates, and you know, Gates might be an old veteran at this point, but he's still going to expose mismatches like the ones that they had in San Diego. So I don't think you're going to see them cover Julius Thomas in the same way that they tried to cover Antonio Gates. But that being said, if they put too much attention on Thomas, got other guys who can beat you, and we haven't mentioned Emmanuel Sanders yet. Let's say that they devote a safety to Julius Thomas on Sunday. And let's say they lead, you know, then you've got a chance where Emmanuel Sanders, if he's not going against Richard Sherman, Emmanuel Sanders might have a chance to be in some one-on-one situations like we saw in the first play against Kansas City last week, where the safeties are watching Julius Thomas and they come up to try to take him out of the play, and they left Marcus Cooper one-on-one, and Emmanuel Sanders ran a post, had a 48-yard gain right out of the blocks. If they put too much safety attention on Julius Thomas, then you're going to see openings like that, and I think the Broncos can expose that because Emmanuel Sanders does have more speed at that receiving position than Eric Decker brought to the equation.
When you look at the Broncos' wide receiving core, there might be a familiar name back on the field this Sunday. With the NFL and NFL Players Association coming to an agreement on the new performance-enhancing substances policy, we've got Wes Welker coming back as an eligible player. Do you think he plays this week, and what might he add against Seattle's defense?
I think it would be a shock if he doesn't play. I think you can pretty well count on that. Obviously, there's some rust to knock off, but it's 2 weeks. We're not talking about a month. In the limited work that we've seen from him in practice, from the open period that we can watch, he's looked good. Cuts are sharp, making catches underneath. Just looks like Wes Welker always has. Now, because, you know, obviously Welker's presence didn't really help the Broncos' offense in the Super Bowl. Again, Seattle was so aggressive, they were able to neutralize him because they were able to disrupt the timing. But if you can, you know, if you can get the other aspects of the offense going, the power aspects going to where they have to play a little less aggressive and be a little more conservative, then I think you're going to see Wes Welker make some plays underneath and I think and cause some problems. And certainly he'll help on third down. And the Broncos' third down offense hasn't been bad, ninth in the league. But last year they converted 45.3% of the third downs they had when they passed the football. Without Wes Welker, the last 2 weeks it was 37.5%, and you know, just under 8% may not sound like a lot, but you know, if you've got enough third downs, that's an extra one. That's at least an extra one that you're converting per game. Some maybe even an extra two that you're converting per game, depending on the situation. So, I think having Welker is going to open some things up. But again, it's predicated on the Broncos having enough power in their offense to force Seattle to be less aggressive.
So we've covered pretty much all the bases here, but one last thing I want to ask is that this may not be any revenge, but what would a win say about this team this season?
Good question. I mean, I think it would say that it has successfully managed to avoid an emotional hangover from a Super Bowl loss. Obviously, it's early. There's a long way to go, but teams in recent history have often, not always, but often had some trouble getting over a Super Bowl defeat, getting past it, and I think a win would show that this team has used the loss in the proper way and has channeled it towards some positive change and also some positive momentum. That being said, I caution everybody listening to this, if you're a Broncos fan, I assume you are if you're listening to this, don't put too much into whether this game is won or lost. This is, you know, this is, as the cliche goes, it's one of 16. But there's so many tough games beyond this that, A, if you win the game, don't want to get too high. You don't want to get too comfortable because there's a lot of teams on the schedule that are capable of beating the Broncos going forward. And if you lose the game, again, the same thing with the schedule. You've got to buck up and you've got to be ready for the Cardinals coming in week five. And the Cardinals have looked very good, especially on defense, even with Carson Palmer having shoulder trouble and hindering that offense a little bit. I mean, I think it can say a lot for the Broncos and how they've put Super Bowl 48 behind them if they win, but it's not the be-all, end-all. I think you can even go back to it wasn't a Super Bowl rematch, but it was an NFC Championship game rematch between Tampa Bay and Philadelphia 11 years ago. You know, Tampa Bay beat Philadelphia in the conference championship that past winter. The Bucs came into Philly and beat the Eagles 17-0 in the first game at Lincoln Financial Field. And, you know, and from that point, the two teams went in different directions. You know, the Bucs finished 7-9 when everyone was kind of crowning them as back-to-back champions after one game. And the Eagles ended up going back to the NFC Championship game for the next two seasons and then went to the Super Bowl in the second of those two seasons. So I would really caution against putting too much into the result, win or lose.
It's going to be a very exciting matchup this Sunday. The game's at 2:25 Mountain Time. A thrilling matchup of the league's best offense and one of the best offenses of all time in the Broncos coming back a little bit healthier with a revamped defense, and you're facing one of the best defenses, you could also say, of all time in the Seahawks. Seattle got the best of it last winter, so hopefully it'll be quite a bit different this time. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and listening to us. When we come back to you next week, we'll be doing a little bit of recap of the season so far, looking ahead, and we'll be taking a look at some of the impacts. We've got a rookie in Bradley Roby who's been playing pretty well, and also some new-look additions from free agency that we'll be very interested to take a look at and see how they've added to this defense and offense.